Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by Boston University's Institute for Philosophy and Religion titled Real and Artificial Beauty, The Mythology of Women and Their Jewelry. Our main speaker is University of Chicago professor Wendy Doniger. Responding to Professor Doniger's lecture will be Boston University Chair of Classics, Professor Stephanie Nelson. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Philosophy and Religion Director, Alan Spate.
Our lecturer is Wendy Doniger, the Mircea Eliade Distinguished Service Professor of the History of Religions in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. She holds appointments also in the Department of South Asian Languages and Civilizations, as well as the Committee on Social Thought and the College at Chicago. A couple of words about her research and teaching, for those of you who might be new to her work. Her research and teaching has focused on translating, interpreting, and comparing elements of Hinduism through modern contexts of gender, sexuality, and identity. Her courses in mythology address themes in cross-cultural expanses such as death, dreams, evil, horses, sex, and women, just to name a few. Her courses in Hinduism cover a broad spectrum that, in addition to mythology, considers literature, law, gender, and zoology. She's published more than 30 books. Some of my favorite titles include Women, Androgynes, and Other Mythical Beasts, Dreams, Illusion, and Other Realities, The Bed Trick, Tales of Sex and Masquerade, The Implied Spider, Politics and Theology and Myth, and The Woman Who Pretended to Be Who She Was. She's currently working on a manuscript, so you'll notice that she has a gift for titles. She's currently working on a manuscript, was just in fact asking me about whether this was the right title, so I'm going to tell you what it is currently, but let you know that it might change. She might change try another title on this. Faking It, which I like that. Faking It, Narratives of Circular Jewelry and Deceptive Women. Wendy, a delight to have you. Please welcome Professor Wendy Doniger.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Alan. So, Real and Artificial Beauty, The Mythology of Women and Their Jewelry. Why are sex and jewelry, particularly circular jewelry, particularly rings, so often connected? The sexual symbolism of finger rings is not subtle. A ring may symbolize physical consummation, and since Shakespeare's time, ring has been a slang term for the female genitalia, just as jewel, bijou, is in French, a term which in English is generally assigned to the male genitalia, as in the expression, the family jewels. From the time of the Romans, rings were associated with betrothal, and by the 13th century, they became to play an important role in marriage, a tradition attributed variously to the Greeks, Romans, and Egyptians, and maybe Steffi will be able to sort this one out for me, and still current in northeast Scotland in the 19th century, made the third finger on the left hand the ring finger and held that it was directly connected to the heart by a vein called the vein of love, vena amoris. Like the link of a chain, a ring, or any form of circular jewelry may fetter the wearer to the giver. Shakespeare's Posthumus in Cymbeline, wrongly suspicious of Imogen's fidelity to him, refers to the bracelet that he gives her as a manacle of love. And this issue of fidelity and infidelity is one of the great themes I'll be talking about. The patterns that link jewelry and the sexuality of women have intricate historical and sociological implications. But a ruthless structuralist can group the narratives into two contrasting paradigms, what I would call the Doris Day scenario of legitimation. Get the gold wedding ring before you go to bed with him. Okay, so two paradigms. The Doris Day scenario of legitimation, get the gold ring before you sleep with him, and the Lorelei Lee Marilyn Monroe scenario of illegitimation, get the diamond ring or bracelet or necklace before you go to bed with him. These two paradigms have different historical trajectories, one from the regulation of marriage by religion, and the other from the survival strategies of women outside the confines of religion. And the tension between them is the driving force behind these narratives. It's what holds the narratives together. The mythology of women and their jewelry often raises issues of authenticity. Both women and their jewels may be replaced by false imitations. That's the faking it scenario. Doubles or forgeries. The women masquerade as other women and are unmasked. The genuine jewels are replaced by identical fakes. romantic infatuation comes up against hard facts, legal challenges, scientific proofs. And in many tales of this corpus, beauty is one of the legitimating or more often illegitimating criteria. Translators all know the old sexist saying often attributed to George Bernard Shaw, translations are like women. If they are beautiful, they can't be faithful. And if they are faithful, they can't be beautiful. So this evening, I'd like to consider two stories about beautiful women and their jewelry from two very different cultures, which ask different questions about the relationship between beauty and fidelity of both women and jewelry. And I want to begin with narcissism in the Arabian Nights. One of the best loved stories in the Arabian Nights, also called the Thousand Nights and a Night, is the tale usually called the story of Kamar al-Zaman. It's a story that was also known in Europe in the 18th and 19th century. George Eliot refers to it. So it's called the story of Kamar, but I think the true protagonist of the tale is not a man at all, Kamar, but a woman, Budur, princess of China. And I would call this story how Budur became the male lover of her husband, Kamar. It's a long tale, and even summarizing will take me about 5 minutes or so, but bear with me, it's really a great story, and you need to know all the bits and pieces to see how they work in this Persian rug pattern. King Shahriman had a handsome son named Kamar al-Zaman. We'll call him Kamar. When his father asked him to marry, he insisted, "Father, I have no wish to marry, nor am I inclined to women, for I've heard tales of their guile and heard verses on their cunning." When he remained adamant, his father, the king, had him imprisoned in a tower. Meanwhile, the beautiful Princess Budur, the daughter of the king of the islands of China, had said, "I have no wish to marry, for I am a sovereign princess who rules over men, and I don't want any man to rule over me." Her father had her imprisoned in a tower. Two jinns, you know, these genies, brought Budur to Kamar's tower in her sleep to determine which was the more beautiful. They laid her beside the young man, and when they uncovered the faces of the two sleeping figures, they looked very much alike, as if they were twins or only brother and sister. First they awakened Kamar, who was stunned by Budur's beauty and desire to make love to her. He undressed her but could not awaken her, for the jinns kept her asleep. He wondered if this was the woman his father wanted him to marry, or if his father had sent the woman to test the sincerity of his resolve not to marry. He therefore refrained from touching her, but in order to have a souvenir, he took from her little finger a ring worth a great deal of money, the author points out, and placed it on his own little finger. The ring was inscribed with a verse that began and ended, "Do not think that I have forgotten your vows. By God, I will remain with you always." Then he turned his back to her and went to sleep. The jinns then awakened Budur, who assumed that Kamar was the man her father had wanted her to marry. She, in turn, tried in vain to awaken him to make love, but the jinns kept him asleep. When she saw her ring on his little finger, she cried out, "I love you, and you love me, but you turn away from me out of coquetry. You came to me while I was asleep, and I do not know what you did to me, but I will not take off my ring from your finger." She took his ring from his finger and put it on her own and kissed his mouth and hands and every spot on his body. Then she took him in her arms, embraced him, and fell asleep. "That must be wrong. I will take my ring off from your finger." The jinns returned. Anyway, they exchanged ring. The jinns returned Budur to China. At dawn, Budur and Kamar awoke, and each remembered the other and saw the ring, but each was told that no one had been there. After 3 years, Budur's stepbrother entered the harem by dressing in women's clothes. He spoke to Budur and promised to help her find her prince. He brought Kamar to the kingdom of Budur. Kamar stained some of his clothes with the blood of a horse and left them behind to make his father think that he had been killed. Kamar sent Budur a letter enclosing her ring. They met and were married, and they made love and slept in each other's arms until the morning. But Kamar worried about his father, who must have thought him dead, and he persuaded Budur to come with him to his own country. On the journey, one day Kamar came upon Budur asleep. Desiring her, he began to remove her pants, whereupon he discovered a blood-red jewel that she had kept tied to the ribbon of her pants and hidden in her most precious part in order to guard it. He took it outside to look at it in the light, and a bird carried it off. When Kamar followed the bird, he fell among evil Magians. Budur awoke to find that he had gone and had taken the jewel without knowing its secret power. Fearing that her servants would make bold with her if they knew her husband was gone, Budur put on some of Kamar's clothes and a turban like his and veiled the lower part of her face and departed, and no one discovered her identity, for she resembled Kamar so much that everyone took her for him. She journeyed to the city of Ebony, where the king said to her, "I've not been blessed with a son, but I have one daughter whose face and body resemble yours in beauty and grace. Will you be willing to live in my country? I'll marry you to my daughter and give you the kingdom." Budur, as Kamar, agreed to this, but when she failed to consummate the marriage, the princess Hayat said, "Is every beautiful person so conceited? I'm not saying this to make you desire me, but I'm saying it out of fear for you from the king, for he is resolved that if you don't take my virginity and consummate the marriage tonight, he will depose you and banish you from his country. He may even become more enraged and kill you." When Budur as Kamar revealed that she was a woman, Hayat said, "I will not divulge your secret." She took a chicken, slaughtered it, and smeared herself with blood. Then she took off her pants and cried out. The women of her family went into her, and her waiting women let out a trilling cry of joy. After some time, Kamar found in the claws of a dead bird the jewel that was the cause of his separation from his wife. He hid it in a cask of gold on a ship that was to take him to the city of Ebony, but the ship sailed without him, and when it landed, Budur as Kamar, now king of the Ebony Islands, found the jewel. Through it, she discovered Kamar's whereabouts and sent her men to capture him and bring him to her. When Kamar arrived, Budur as Kamar said to him, "I love you for your surpassing beauty and grace, and if you grant me my desire, I will grant you favors, make you prosperous, appoint you vizier, just as the people made me king in spite of my youth." When Kamar heard this, he felt embarrassed and blushed until his cheeks seemed on fire, and he said, "I have no need of favors that lead to sin." Budur as Kamar kept arguing with him, reciting many obscene verses about men who prefer sex with boys to sex with women. At last, Kamar said, "Your Majesty, if you must do it, promise me that you will do it to me only once." He opened his trousers, feeling extremely embarrassed and shedding tears in fear. Budur as Kamar smiled, took him with her to bed, and said, "After tonight, you will experience nothing offensive again." When Kamar discovered that she lacked male genitals, he said to himself, "Perhaps this king is a hermaphrodite, being neither male nor female." So he said to her, "Your Majesty, you don't seem to be like other men. What then moved you to carry on like this?" When Budur as Kamar heard this, she laughed until she fell on her back. And she said, "Oh, my darling, how quickly you have forgotten the nights we spent together." Then she revealed herself to him, and he recognized her as his wife, Budur. So he embraced her, and she embraced him, and he kissed her, and she kissed him, and they made love. Then he began to remonstrate with her, saying, "What made you treat me like this tonight?" She replied, "Do not reproach me, for I only did it in jest to increase the pleasure and joy." He married Hayat, and Budur, who was not jealous, willingly became her maidservant and co-wife. He conducted himself in a praiseworthy way toward his people and lived with his wives in happiness and delight and fidelity and cheerfulness, spending one night with each in turn. And in some versions of the Arabian Nights, which exist in many different variants, there's no single original one, in some versions, the story ends there, but many of them add this second very brief piece, one more paragraph. But when the two women bore and raised sons, each woman fell in love with the other's son, propositioned him, was rejected, and accused the boy of rape. Kamar believed the women at first and ordered the boys killed, but they were spared and proved their innocence with the help of Budur's father and Kamar's father. Budur returned to her father's kingdom, and her son ruled there, while Hayat's son ruled on the throne of her father, and Kamar al-Zaman went back and ruled his father's kingdom. Though Kamar longs for Budur as much as she longs for him, it is she who takes the active role in bringing them together on both occasions. Yet she never has to prove who she is. It is Kamar who must prove his identity. Budur, by contrast, remains disguised as she takes political power and forces Kamar into a bed that he loathes, for he thinks it is the bed of a man. Budur looks so like her husband that she can take his place. What does Kamar think when Budur's Kamar drags him into bed? That he's looking into a mirror? That every good-looking person looks just like him? The fact that her natural resemblance to her husband allows Budur to play the role of a man, her man, lends this version of the story an unusual symmetry, which is foreshadowed from the very start when each desires the other at first sighting but fails to awaken the other and hence cannot satisfy his or her desire. And throughout the story, they do similar things. He uses the blood of a horse to fake his death. She uses the blood of a chicken to fake the consummation of the wedding and so forth. The resemblance between the two lovers is particularly striking because they're not only not related by blood at all, so that family resemblance cannot explain the likeness, but are not even of the same ethnic background. He is presumably Arabian and she Chinese. And Budur resembles not only Kamar, but the daughter of the king who takes her to be a boy, presumably a dark-skinned woman from the Ebony Isles. The hegemony of beauty and grace, as it's referred to in the story, erases not only the difference between individuals, but the difference between genders, and transcends even the boundaries of ethnicity. It is a supreme quality. Although we end up with the official normal Middle Eastern combination of a man, Kamar, who sleeps with two women, Hayat and Budur, the narrative brings us there through the far from normal detour of an apparent man, Budur as Kamar, who pretends to sleep first with a woman, Hayat, who thinks she is a man, same sex, different gender, and then with a man, Kamar, who thinks she is a man, same gender, different sex. Kamar, at the very start of the story, does not like women. He argues that he will not marry because he has heard verses about the cunning of women. Kamar's expectations are then more than met by the elaborate trick that his wife plays upon him while citing precisely the sort of verses that Kamar must have had in mind. Kamar's actions speak louder than his words. He keeps protesting that he loves her, but he does turn his back on her in bed on their first meeting. He does walk out on her after their marriage, and he has to be dragged, kicking, and screaming into bed with her at the end, thinking that she is a man. But still, he doesn't recognize her, even when he recognizes her genitals. Budur may well blame Kamar for having left her and robbed her. She comments blandly, it seems that he has taken the jewel and gone, as well as for turning his back to her in bed on their first encounter. This unexpressed or repressed resentment may best explain her quite evident sadistic pleasure in tormenting both Hayat and Kamar. Budur's Kamar is quite willing to humiliate the entirely innocent Hayat. When Budur fails to consummate the marriage with Hayat, just as Kamar had failed to consummate his first assignation with Budur, Hayat wonders, is every beautiful person so conceited? She's wrong about the primary reason for Budur's rejection of her, but not entirely wrong. Budur's narcissism limits the field of her lovers, not to herself, but to someone who closely or exactly resembles her. But it is Kamar whom Budur as Kamar truly humiliates when he thinks she is the king. Her own rather lame excuse, I only did it in jest, explains nothing but the pleasure that the trickster takes in manipulating others and keeping them in the power of the trickster's knowledge and the victim's ignorance. The closeted sexual motive seemed to me to make the best sense of this twisted story. She plays the trick on her husband in order to exert power over him as he had exerted power over her, to put him, and as she feared from the start that her husband would do, to put him in danger of being raped, just as his absence had put her in danger of being raped. And his initial rejection of her had left her with the suspicion that he might have raped her in her sleep. Quote, "You came to me while I was asleep, and I do not know what you did to me." Budur's revenge extends into the last part of the story when she betrays him, when she betrays Kamar, by claiming that she has slept with his son by the other woman. The blithe statement that Kamar lived with his wives in happiness and delight and fidelity and cheerfulness, spending one night with each in turn, evokes the Middle Eastern tradition that goes spectacularly awry in the Hebrew Bible story of Rachel and Leah, and fares little better here, where the fidelity and cheerfulness is certainly short-lived. The women proposition one another's sons, are rejected, and cry rape. We know this as the Potiphar's wife scenario in the Hebrew Bible, Genesis 39, reprocessing rejection as rape, and it is one of the reasons for the frequent conflation of these two aspects of sex, which appear to be polar opposites, rape and rejection. The fact that the solution to all of this transvestism and quasi-incest is to send the women home to live with their fathers might give a Freudian pause. But Kamar, too, ends up in his father's realm. And it was in order to return to his father that Kamar left Budur in the first place. Here, I think the return to the fathers indicates little more than one more example of the virulent misogyny, and in this case, the literal patriarchy of the story. But it is the narcissism rather than the misogyny that contributes most to our understanding of this permutation of the theme, for such excessive self-regard is surely one of the sources of self-imitation. If you cannot think of anyone you like better than yourself, why imitate anyone else? Moreover, since Kamar exactly resembles Budur, in imitating him, she is imitating herself. The love of Budur and Kamar for partners who resemble them demonstrates the devastating self-reflexivity of narcissistic love. Budur is so beautiful that everyone who sees her is jealous even of himself, says the text. A remark, I left that out of the telling, but it's in the same story. Everyone who sees her is jealous even of himself. A remark suggestive of the sexual transformations that allow a prince in a contemporary Indian story to make love to his own left half. They are alike, too, in the incestuous overtones of their narcissism. Before Budur and Kamar meet, neither wishes to marry. On the surface, they have very different reasons. He distrusts all women while she doesn't want to give up her freedom. But deeper down, we encounter the same reason in both of them. He admires only his mother, the text tells us, while she prefers her father to any other husband or lover. Quote, "Anyone that did not know the king or father of this incomparable princess would be apt to imagine, from the great respect and kindness he shows her, that he was in love with his daughter. Never did lover do more for a mistress, the most endearing, than he has been seen to do for her. In a word, never was jealousy more watchful over one than he is over her." End quote. The narcissistic self replaces the self, projects the self onto all other love objects, resembles them, and finally becomes them. Beauty plays a very similar role in the story of the two viziers, which is probably older than the tale of Budur. In both stories, one male and one female jinn catch sight of a beautiful woman and a beautiful man who are asleep in far distant cities. The jinns think that A, each is surpassingly beautiful, the male jinn admires the woman, the female jinn the man, and B, they look alike. The theme of narcissism and of a single non-gendered standard of beauty is thus a basic underpinning of both plots. The jinns bring the lovers together for one night and then part them again, leaving them to find one another in both stories. But in the two viziers, the lovers consummate their love on the first night, whereas Kamar and Budur do not. And in the two viziers, there's no ring. Instead, there is an elaborate series of tests by which the hero proves that he was in bed with the woman. the taste of the pomegranate he cooks, the reconstruction of an entire room that he recognizes, and so forth. This contrast is an indication that the ring and the tale of Budor, however muted, still bears a major proportion of the weight of the proof of identity. And it is Budor who masterminds that proof, for she's the one who breaks out of the initial conventional situation of amazing physical identity with her lover to become a most unconventional woman and someone quite different from him in every way, more active, more powerful, and more deceptive. Yet she can only accomplish her goal of union with him by pretending to be him, using her cleverness to play upon the convention of their identical beauty. So that's part one. Part two, real fake necklaces. Let us now jump over hundreds of years and thousands of miles to 19th and 20th century Europe and consider the question of fake jewelry. What is it that connects an anxiety about the authenticity of fake jewelry with an anxiety about the authenticity of fake women, which is to say untrue, unfaithful, promiscuous, and above all, beautiful women? Why are diamonds a girl's best friend? More precisely, what kind of a girl is it who thinks diamonds are her best friend? Normally, fake diamonds pretend to be real. Guy de Maupassant, in The Necklace, La Parure, 1885, told of a poor woman named Mathilde who borrowed a diamond necklace from her rich friend, Madame Forestier, so that she could wear it to enhance and show off her beauty at a ball that would introduce her into society. This was going to make her fortune. She lost the necklace, purchased for 36,000 francs, an identical replacement, which she returned to the owner without telling her of the substitution. Madame Forestier did not notice any difference. Mathilde ruined her beauty and her life by putting herself and her husband in hard labor for 10 years to repay the money they had to borrow to buy the replacement. Years later, Mathilde confessed to Madame Forestier what she had done, whereupon Madame Forestier told her that the necklace she had borrowed was a fake worth only 500 francs. Neither of the women could tell the difference between the real thing and the fake. Mathilde mistook the fake for real, and Madame Forestier the real for the fake. Thus, real diamonds stood in for the fakes that had stood in for real diamonds. When J. Reid Gould adapted this story for his one-act play in 1969, he had Madame Forestier remark to Mathilde at the end, with hard-hearted French or perhaps American logic, "Who would lend someone a real necklace? We keep it safe under lock and key." So that's the American contribution to the story. And in parallel to the shift from a real necklace to a fake necklace, the one real thing that Mathilde has, her beauty, is destroyed by the jewelry, by the need to work so hard to repay the debt that her beauty is ruined. Guy de Maupassant also had written a year earlier, in 1884, another story about a real necklace that pretended to be a fake, called Les Bijoux, often translated the fake jewels. A married woman had an uncanny knack of stretching the meager household budget to produce luxuries, including a great deal of fake jewelry. After her death, her husband discovered with a shock that her apparently fake jewelry was real. The shock came from his assumption that if the jewels were real, they must have been received for services rendered, and that the woman, therefore, must have been false. But he got over the shock, cheerfully sold the jewelry, and lived in luxury with a second, more virtuous wife. This was a basic theme which other authors could dance their own original variations on. Henry James, in 1899, reversed the tone of Les Bijoux in his story entitled Paste. Arthur Prime had inherited the estate of his father, who, as a widowed cleric, a vicar, had conceived for an obscure actress several years older than himself an admiration that led to marriage. Now both of them were dead. Arthur offered his stepmother's fake jewels, stage jewels, to his cousin Charlotte, a governess. The jewels, much lighter than the material they imitated, were too dreadfully good to be true. Flagrant tinsel and glass, they looked strangely vulgar, shameless pinchbeck. And of course, like everyone else, Charlotte knew that her aunt had had no jewelry to speak of. But the necklace of pearls as big as filberts was surprisingly heavy, and she commented on this to Arthur. "Are you sure, very sure, they're not really worth something?" He replied brusquely, "If they had been worth anything to speak of, she would long ago have sold them. Besides, how could she ever have come by them? If they were real, presumably she must have received them from some wealthy man." Charlotte accepted all the jewels, including the pearls, and thought nothing of them until a woman of the world, Mrs. Guy, saw them and insisted that the pearls were in fact real. Furious at the shadow that Charlotte's decision cast on his stepmother's character, Arthur insisted they're rotten paste and determined to take them to Bond Street to have them appraised. He wrote to Charlotte that she had insulted his stepmother, that the experts had determined that he was right and pronounced them utter paste, and that he had smashed them. But when she next met Mrs. Guy, Charlotte saw that she was wearing the pearls. Mrs. Guy said she had recognized them in the window of a Bond Street jeweler who must have purchased them from Arthur and had bargained for them. In the end, Charlotte wondered if Mrs. Guy hadn't gotten them from Arthur. And that final line implies, I think, that Arthur, who had been so horrified to think that his aunt might have received jewelry for sexual favors, gave the pearls to Mrs. Guy, a woman of the world, in precisely such a transaction. W. Somerset Maugham's story entitled Mr. Know-All, published in 1925, shares the assumption that underlies the de Maupassant and James stories, but brings in other interesting issues. The narrator seems to be anti-Semitic, and one of the issues that I wonder about is whether the narrator is an anti-Semite that Maugham doesn't like, or whether Maugham shares his opinions of the Jews. It's hard to tell from the story, but listen to it. The story begins, "I was prepared to dislike Max Calada even before I knew him." Max Calada is a Jew who pretends to be English. The narrator, who is forced to room with him on a transatlantic voyage, regards him as a fake gentleman. Quote, "King George has many strange subjects. Mr. Calada was short and of sturdy build, clean-shaven and dark-skinned, with a fleshy, hooked nose and very large, lustrous, and liquid eyes. His long black hair was sleek and curly. He spoke with a fluency in which there was nothing English, and his gestures were exuberant. I felt pretty sure that a closer inspection of that British passport of his would have betrayed the fact that Mr. Calada was born under a bluer sky than is generally seen in England." So that's what the narrator thinks of Mr. Calada. Max Calada is an obnoxious and self-promoting nuisance, and everyone calls him Mr. Know-All. One night at dinner with a Mr. Ramsay and his wife, a very pretty little thing, who has been alone in New York for a year during her husband's absence in Japan, Mr. Calada comments on Mrs. Ramsay's pearl necklace. When Ramsay remarks, "I didn't buy it myself, of course. I'd be interested to know how much you think it cost," Calada estimates $30,000. Then, and now I quote, Ramsay smiled grimly. "You'll be surprised to learn that Mrs. Ramsay bought that string at a department store the day before we left New York for $18. When Calada insists that the pearls are real, Ramsay bets him $100 that they're imitations. Over Mrs. Ramsay's protests, Calada examines the pearls with a magnifying glass he has in his pocket. Then, and I quote, a smile of triumph spread over his smooth and swarthy face. He handed back the chain. He was about to speak. Suddenly, he caught sight of Mrs. Ramsay's face. It was so white that she looked as though she were about to faint. She was staring at him with wide and terrified eyes. They held a desperate appeal. It was so clear that I wondered why her husband didn't see it. Mr. Calada stopped with his mouth open. He flushed deeply. You could almost see the effort he was making over himself. I was mistaken, he said. It's a very good imitation, but of course, as soon as I looked through my glass, I saw that it wasn't real. I think $18 is just about as much as the damn thing's worth. He took out his pocketbook and from it a $100 bill. He handed it to Ramsey without a word. "Perhaps that'll teach you not to be so cocksure another time, my young friend," said Ramsey as he took the note. I noticed that Mr. Calada's hands were trembling. The story spread over the ship, as stories do, and he had to put up with a good deal of chaff that evening. It was a fine joke that Mr. Knowall had been caught out. But Mrs. Ramsey retired to her stateroom with a headache. The next morning, an envelope arrives in Calada's stateroom with nothing but a $100 bill. The narrator asks him, "Were the pearls real?" And Calada replies, "If I had a pretty little wife, I shouldn't let her spend a year in New York while I stayed at Kobe." And the story ends with this two sentences. At that moment, I did not entirely dislike Mr. Calada. He reached out for his pocketbook and carefully put in it the $100 note. It's a great story. So by faking an opinion that the pearls are fake, by saying falsely that the real pearls are false, Calada simultaneously saves the woman's reputation and ruins his own. He behaves like a real gentleman. He shows that he himself is as real as the pearls, but nobody, with the exception of the narrator and you, gentle reader, knows this. They all go on believing that the pearls and Mr. Knowall are fakes and the woman is real. Mom, in 1943, wrote a satire on his own story. He wrote a story called A String of Beads, this is the last story I'll tell you, which a narrator tells to Mom. A governess standing in at a dinner party for a fashionable woman who had canceled at the last minute was wearing a string of pearls that an expert at the dinner insisted was genuine, worth £50,000, though the governess strenuously insisted that she had paid only 15 shillings for it. Here the person telling the story to Mom remarks, "We all laughed. It was, of course, absurd. We've all heard of wives palming off on their husbands as false, a string of pearls that was real and expensive. That story is as old as the hills." And Mom, retelling the story, continues, "Thank you," I said, thinking of a little narrative of my own. Eventually, the truth emerges. The governess had taken her own cheap pearls to be mended, and the jeweler had given her, by mistake, someone else's real pearls. The mistake is detected, the necklaces exchanged again, and the governess receives a reward that she uses to set herself up as a demi-mondaine in Paris, presumably able to get her own real jewelry from rich lovers. As the governess had substituted for a real member of high society, so real pearls had substituted chiasmically for her fakes. Mom makes fun of his own earlier story here in conscious self-parody, as well as the spirit of intertextuality, because he had, of course, stolen it from de Maupassant in the first place. In many old stories, that a man accuses a woman of unchastity only to have the woman produce the man's ring given to her on the occasion of their liaison to prove that it was the man, in fact, who was unchaste. The ring also validates the woman's child as the true heir. Think of the tale of Tamar and Judah in the Hebrew Bible, Genesis 38, or Shakespeare's All's Well That Ends Well, or Terence's Roman comedy, The Mother-in-Law, that I had the pleasure of discussing with your classics department last year, which is another one of these, the ring proves that the guy was the one who slept with the woman. In the modern stories of necklaces, the woman's jewelry given by the man proves, on the other hand, that she was in fact unchaste. Why this reversal at this time? It's perhaps not a coincidence that this last group of stories about necklaces arises at a time, the mid and late 19th century, when women were agitating for their rights. It was at this time, too, in 1848, that Alexandre Dumas Père wrote his novel about an affair that actually had taken place in 1784 and 5, involving a fabulously expensive diamond necklace that was real enough but was falsely said to have been bought by Marie Antoinette or given to her by Cardinal de Rohan, who was falsely accused of having been the queen's lover. In fact, the cardinal had been tricked in the half-light of a garden at night by a prostitute who resembled and impersonated the queen namely a fake queen, and who persuaded Rohan to buy the necklace, which he thought was given to the queen, but was actually broken up and sold. This is the history. The fictionalized versions are more lurid, and together they led to a notorious trial and contributed to the French Revolution. The 19th century stories may also reflect a class anxiety. A recurring theme in 19th century French novels is the shop girl who now dresses so well that she can pass herself off as a real lady. Recall that line in My Fair Lady, Shaw's Pygmalion, 1916, when Henry Higgins boasts that he'll be able to pass Eliza off as a duchess or even get her a job in a nice shop for which the standards would be still higher. Here again, the real thing is not as good as the fake, and there's also the issue of language, of course, there too. So, a couple of words of conclusion. What's the conceptual thread on which we can string all these gems of stories? There are a lot. The one I want to talk about now is the assumption that jewelry is somehow proof of sexual contact, whether it be the ring that proves that Kamar and Budur slept together or the necklace that proves the promiscuity of Max Kalada's dinner partner. And both sorts of jewelry are subject to the accusation of faking it, though in different ways. 19th and 20th century authors de Maupassant, James, and Maugham are concerned with the paradoxical judgment that the fake may be more valuable than the real, a theme that has also become quite trendy in 20th and 21st century postmodernism. The wedding ring, on the other hand, the Doris Day ring, is the piece of jewelry that makes the wife a good woman. It's official marital, given to her by the unique man she's supposed to love, her legal man, her husband, in return for sleeping only with him. And she damn well better keep it. If she loses it, she loses her authenticity. By contrast, a woman gets other forms of circular jewelry, necklaces or bracelets or anklets in India, or even other kinds of rings, the Marilyn Monroe jewelry, from men, the plural is significant, other than her husband, in payment for sleeping with them, which makes her lose her authenticity. But if she can prove that jewelry is a fake, or often, but not always the same thing and a more modern variant, if she can prove that she bought it herself, she remains authentic. And so Mr. Ramsey so smugly remarks, you'll be surprised to learn that Mrs. Ramsey bought that string at a department store the day before we left New York for $18. Considerations of the changing social context of these stories shift our focus to the outer level of the narrative frame, where the cross-cultural corpus of stories about fake jewelry shows us how widespread is the desire of male narrators to fake it, to cast moral aspersions on one of the few sources of women's independence, their jewelry. And I can say more about that, about how throughout recorded human history, women have seldom, if ever, been allowed to own property, but they have had their own portable jewelry, their own portable property, their jewelry, which is also sometimes the portable property of the family, their husband's wealth as well. So jewelry has a lot of significance for independence. If a woman was beaten up just once too often by her husband, then she could leave him and there was no legal divorce, she could at least exist if she could keep her jewelry. So there's that. In A String of Beads, Maugham makes fun of his own earlier story in conscious self-parody, as well as a sophisticated awareness of the fact that if a story about fake jewelry is recycled often enough, like a woman passing from lover to lover, it is likely to be taken as false even if it is true. Oh, that's a story. We know that story. And here I want to say more in the book about the conventions of storytelling, why it is that every time in Hebrew Bible, Genesis 3:8, Shakespeare, the guy says, I never saw you before, I never slept with you, and she says, yeah, what about the ring? And he says, oh my God, you're right. I've caught out. The ring doesn't prove anything. And there are a lot of stories that argue that it doesn't prove anything. There are later Jewish retellings in the Testament of Judah of the story of Tamar and Judah, where she says, yeah, this is, what about this ring, hey, Judah? And he says, you could have gotten that ring from another woman. You could have stolen it. It proves nothing whatsoever. And yet there's a convention in the story that the ring will legitimate her. So it's considered, that if you know the story enough, it's taken to be false even if it's true. And if we jump from the concerns of the people inside the stories to the concerns of the narrators on the frames, we can see that another kind of faking it, which is the narrator's skill in maintaining the illusion and the audience's collusion with him, that if you can get someone's ring, you can prove that they slept with you. Or that if you can prove that a woman has real jewelry that her husband did not give her, you can prove that she was unfaithful to him. The protagonists of these stories are primarily concerned with the chastity of the women, and therefore not so much with the genuineness of their jewelry as about its provenance. The big question is not, is the jewelry real, but what did the women do to get it? And the main evidence for the prosecution in the ongoing trial of chaste and unchaste women is the testimony of their beauty. We know nothing at all about Budor except that she is very beautiful and Chinese. We know absolutely nothing about Mrs. Ramsey, not her age, the color of her hair, whether she has children, whether she's smart or stupid, well-educated or up from the slums, except that she is, quote, a very pretty little thing and, quote, a pretty little wife. That's enough to damn them both. Jewelry and beauty play a game of doubles here. On the one hand, men give jewelry to beautiful women to get them to sleep with them. On the other hand, jewelry is said to enhance the beauty of women, to make them desirable so that men will want to sleep with them. It's a circle, like the circle of a necklace or a ring. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Doniger. Our respondent this evening is Professor Stephanie Nelson, who is chair of classics here at BU. Like our speaker tonight, her publication and teaching is characterized by a wide and genuinely interdisciplinary range. She's author of one of the most remarkable books ever written on farming and classics, God and the Land, and she has also translated Hesiod's Works and Days. But the list of authors she has published on is quite diverse. Plato, Shelley, Swift, Joyce, Milton, T.E. Lawrence, and she's currently working on the relation between tragedy and comedy in a book, I hope I have your title right, Aristophanes' Tragic Muse, Tragedy, Comedy, and the Polis in Classical Athens.
I thought I'd just pick up on one particular thread that intrigued me, which is this kind of overall idea of the trope of beauty and the relationship to kind of overall question of authenticity. And it seemed to me, the more I thought about it, it seemed incredibly paradoxical, and yet the drive of a lot of stories, a lot of where things were coming from, is not only that there can be a beauty in fake objects, so that paste jewels can be beautiful, but that there's almost like a fake beauty, which shouldn't be possible, obviously, since beauty is appearance. It doesn't make any sense to say that something is, you know, beautiful and false. And yet, and again, this is obviously in a philosophical and religious, sort of series on aesthetics, I suppose, to say that beauty is problematic is not making a radical claim in any way. So as I was thinking about sort of the stories, it seemed to me that your part one and your part two went in two different ways, which I think makes perfect sense. So that in part one, at first, I was thinking about the idea of fake beauty, and then I was thinking about gender. So that
she fakes being a man.
Exactly. So yeah. Budor is beautiful, but the fake beauty her beauty becomes fake beauty when it's no longer female, but masculine. Mm-hmm. But the more I thought about it, see, I really love the narcissism part. The more I see, now again, I know I'm importing something that, is not part of the Arabian Nights, but it actually ended up reminding me of, it's almost like a platonic form of beauty. And as you said,
yes,
you know, as you put it, it's like it's as a single non-gendered standard of beauty. And this, you know, incredible point that not only does the beautiful man and the beautiful women are identical, but the beautiful Persian and the beautiful black woman and the beautiful Chinese woman are all in some bizarre way identical.
That's right.
As if there's some standard of beauty. And then it really seemed that it becomes that in and of itself, and what you call the narcissism, becomes really problematic. And I'm hoping you'll talk about this more. I thought this idea of, on the one hand, you have the exchanging the rings, and that seems to be the normal trope. And then, you know, that's how you identify each other by the rings. But then this funny idea of the jewel that she has kept for herself.
Yes.
In her, you know, private parts, that finally she recovers and it comes back to her. It's about, it's her jewel, it's not an exchange jewel. It's almost as if she's not dependent on anybody else. She's so beautiful. I thought, you know, the Rilke quote about, you know, beauty is akin to terror. And, you know, it's something that we respect because it serenely disdains to destroy us. But that level of beauty and self-sufficiency, and of course both of them, both Kamar and Budur, don't want to marry. It's as if they don't need anybody else at that level of beauty. So that it seemed to me in a way that it was almost as if the whole trope, which, you know, starts by seeing, you know, these are the two lovers, they're separated, they need to come back together again. In fact, actually, they need to be separated. And that, and again, that I didn't have when I was looking at the story, but I had it from your paper, of course, this idea of their falling in love with each other's sons. But that idea, presumably, since they are similar, all three of them are similar.
The sons are going to be similar, too.
And so they're falling in love with themselves.
That's
so they're falling in love with themselves. And that they need to each be separated
really
off to their own kingdom. Yeah. So that rather than lovers coming together, they have to be separated.
Because the sons, after all, have the same father to begin with. And then they have two mothers who are described as identical.
And who look like the father.
Yeah, right,
yeah,
that's right.
Exactly,
yeah,
yeah.
Well, Professor Doniger, we thank you.
Thank you for all your good ideas.
Well, let's offer you a genuine token of our...
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by University of Chicago Professor Wendy Doniger titled Real and Artificial Beauty, The Mythology of Women and Their Jewelry. Responding to Professor Doniger's lecture was Boston University Chair of Classics, Professor Stephanie Nelson. Tonight's moderator was Alan Spate, Director of the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, sponsor of this evening's event. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Paul Vikas. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.